Jenkins. "Your name?" said Blackstone.
"Robert de Rabastain."
"You have my thanks, Robert."
Rabastain nodded and then placed a bandaged stump on Blackstone's arm. Blackstone never wavered, but looked into the man's eyes.
"Before you meet your enemy, you will pass close to the village of Saint-Bernice de la Grave," said the leper. "For many years before Poitiers, 10 or more, I served at my king's command. I fought pagans in the Holy Roman Empire, Routiers in Lorraine, the English in France, any enemy that challenged my king. My wife and children saw nothing of me. I never watched my children grow. I had made a vow before God that if I survived fighting the English that day at Poitiers, that I would return home. I was wounded and spent weeks recovering, and by the time I reached the outskirts of Saint-Bernice, I knew it was more than battle wounds that ailed me. So I did not go back, but let it be thought I had died. My wife remarried the lord of the manor, Mouton de la Grave, who took in my sons, and they in turn took his name. 2 died of the plague, but the third, Alain, is near enough a grown man. Lord de la Grave is a good knight, and he may stand in your way. He is loyal to King John, and even with the king's command, I do not think he will relinquish his town or his loyalty easily. I ask a favor."
Blackstone placed his hand on what remained of the man's. "No harm will befall your son from me or my men," he said. A tear glistened in the once proud man's eyes.
He nodded his thanks.
"I shall tell him that his father still holds him close in his heart."
Rabastain shook his head. "I am dead. Let it remain so."
Chapter 15. As the men filed their way out of the forest, Blackstone did not look back. The leper, who had once fought as a man-at-arms at the French king's side, had melted back into the shadows. Courage on the battlefield, Blackstone understood, for it was underpinned by rage and fear. But the fortitude to survive the loss of that life as a soldier, and then abandonment by family and community, was something he could not comprehend. His own grief at the loss of his family was tempered with loving memory, which gave him the strength to fight on. He doubted he had the kind of resolve needed to endure a living death like the leper. They rode 16 miles south without incident. Kilbert and Griffith ap Madoc traded stories of the years since Blackstone last saw them fighting shoulder to shoulder on the field at Crecy.
"It was the nun that did it for me," said Kilbert. "Damned if she didn't steal my heart. I remember it as if it were yesterday."
"As do we all," said Blackstone.
"I have not mentioned this story for at least 2 years," said Kilbert.
"Not so. We hear this story every time Gilbert stops to take a piss."
"Having your cock in your hand brings back memories," said Kilbert defensively.
"You didn't marry the nun," said the Welshman.
"She was promised to others," chirped in Blackstone. "The whole damned monastery."
Kilbert scowled.
"It is true she was a woman who had an appetite, but you can only do so much praying in your life. The loins ache for physical comfort."
Griffith grinned. "By the sound of it, it wasn't an ache, but an itch.
I see I am in coarse company. Where is your respect for a man's confession of love?" complained Kilbert.
"Let's be clear, Gilbert. Your heart was ruled by your balls," said Blackstone. "But what confuses me was whether this was the first nun or the other."
"There were 2, said ap Madoc.
"Oh, at least," said Blackstone. "But I know only of 2.
"You mock a man unfairly," said Kilbert in a wounded tone. "She was an angel searching to bring heathens like me to the Mother Church."
Griffith laughed.
"Lead me to her. I'll abandon the old gods."
Gilbert reverted to his heathen ways and beat the monks, and, I've forgotten. "What did you do to the nun?" said Blackstone. Kilbert ignored the question.
"And then, years later, I was riding in the forest,
and found Thomas here, surrounded by men ready to kill him. That was just before Poitiers. What he fails to mention is that I saved his life that day.
And he has told the same story ever since, said Blackstone.
As the wind settled, Blackstone saw, several miles ahead, the murky haze of smoke that smothered the clouds. He spurred the men across the rolling ground and then urged the horses on as it rose before them. As they crested the hill, they saw that where a village had once huddled a mile ahead, bitter-tasting smoke now swirled through the destroyed houses. Bodies lay scattered, villagers desperate to escape the terror that had swept down on them. Smouldering corpses lay scattered along a track through a small coppice, whose trees had been seared by wind-whipped flames. Wherever these people had been running to, they had been too slow, or the violence that had come upon them had been too swift. Blackstone and his men trotted forward, swords drawn, but there was no sign of the attackers. The hamlet was bereft of livestock, and spilled corn told a story of grain stores being looted. A cow lay dead, its udder empty, milked and slain to deny others. Rats scurried over the fallen bodies, some burrowing into carcasses via open wounds. As the men skirted the burning village, Blackstone saw trampled ground. Horsemen must have used the shallow river that meandered along the far side of the buildings to approach, probably at first light, masking their noise with the sound of water and churned up the bank when climbing ashore. The hoof prints showed there must have been a large group of horsemen, 100 or more at least. Blackstone called to Griffith ap Madoc. Split your men and encircle the village. Then sweep through in force. If the raiders are ahead of us, we will be on their heels. This killing is only hours old. For a moment it looked as though the Welshman would argue, but the ferocity of the recent attack stopped any objection he might harbour at being commanded by Blackstone. As ap Madoc wheeled his mount and shouted his orders, Blackstone led his men along the track. They would be the first to strike against any enemy that remained at the slaughtered village. The mud of the track was churned up. Whoever had attacked this place had swept through the hovels, struck down the villagers, and surged onward down this path. A half-mile down the track, the woodland opened out into another clearing. A low-walled, fortified house stood 200 paces away. The gates were open, and a dozen bodies slumped over the parapet here and there. The attackers had overwhelmed a local lord or seneschal, the man responsible for protecting the villagers. Blackstone's men quickly fanned out as Will Longdon dismounted his archers and formed a defensive line across the clearing. If there were still raiders behind the walls, they would be brought down moments after any attempt to escape. Blackstone and his men looked at the scene of destruction. The lord's house sat within the centre of the wall, surrounded by a courtyard. A small family chapel had lost its roof, its bare timbers smouldering. No sound came from behind the walls. Blackstone eased the bastard horse at the walk, his men following. Whoever the house belonged to, its owner had secured it as best as he could. It was the kind of stronghold common across France. A local lord and his family with a small retinue of foot soldiers, probably no more than 20 or so men, crossbow and pikemen usually, the kind of small force that would be called upon by the king in time of war. There were thousands of such local fiefs, and once brought under the fleur-de-lis, gave a French king a great army. The kind of army that the English king had defeated on the field of battle. The trees had been cleared far enough from the walls to give the lord of the manor's men a good killing ground, but it appeared that this attack had been so sudden that the alarm had been barely raised before the swarm of men overpowered the defences. Moulin and Jean Jacob had gone forward and reconnoitred the far side of the walls. Moulin reined in.
The ground is churned from the gates, around the walls and then beyond the far clearing, said the Norman.
Whoever was here was in force, Thomas, but it looks as though they've gone, said John Jacob, handing Blackstone a torn piece of cloth. It bore bloodstains.
There are a few bodies at the foot of the walls brought down by crossbows. This was one of them.
Blackstone turned the cloth over and looked at the design of a barbed arrowhead. Bretons, said Blackstone.
Some of the men fighting for Charles de Blois, said John Jacob.
Blackstone called Perrine forward.
Take 5 men. Follow the tracks. Be back before nightfall.
Perrine turned his horse and called the nearest men to him. "All right," said Blackstone. "Let's see if anyone survived the attack." He led the men through the gates. It was too small, a fortified house, to warrant a portcullis or defensive ditch, and there was no sign of the gates being smashed open. Peasant smocks lay abandoned just inside the gate. "Like as not, they talked their way in," said Kilbert. "They kill and chase villagers, take their clothing, beg for entry, and once the gates are opened, quickly kill the sentries. And then it's a quick gallop from the trees, and the routiers are in." Blackstone glanced at him. "You can be sure they're part of the horde that John Chandos is hunting," said Kilbert, in answer to the unspoken question. "Sure of it." Blackstone nodded. It made sense that the closer they got to Chandos, the more evidence there would be of the Breton routier army that was gathering. Inside the walls, there were signs of the fight all around them. Bodies lay where they had fallen. Another 20 or so of the knight's men, crossbows flung from their hands, some with swords still in the scabbard. So quick had been the surge through the gates that those in the yard, perhaps still running for the walls, had had no chance to draw them. Three servants were propped against the main house entrance, their blood splattered across the iron-studded door. Kitchen knives and a hand scythe had been their only weapons, useless against battle-axe, mace, or sword. But their death at the entrance was testimony to their courage, as they had tried to stop the killers from entering the Lord's house. One was disemboweled, another had a severed arm. Their companion's throat had been cut. Wisps of smoke swirled as the breeze caught embers in the deep thatch that covered the buildings to one side of the yard. Soldiers' quarters, most likely, thought Blackstone. Four attackers lay dead at the feet of two men who had fallen half in, half out of the entrance. "Small company of men," said John Jacob. Moulin eased his horse towards them. "No sign of anyone alive out here. A few attackers dead near the grain store along with servants. Five women inside. Raped. Throats cut. I covered them with sacking." He hesitated. "And what's probably their children? They spared no one. Their bloodlust was up." He spat. "Bastards should be spitted and roasted, Sir Thomas. If these are the Skinners we are after, they need no mercy shown them when it comes to it." "Once they got over the wall in numbers, these people stood no chance," said Kilbert. He glanced at Blackstone. The sight was eerily reminiscent of when they had fought the Jacquerie while searching for Blackstone's family a few years before. They had come across a similar scene of a local lord's household butchered and raped. Blackstone had remained stony-faced. "All right. Secure the walls. Bring in Will and the others. Renfred, ride to Ap Madoc. Tell him what we've seen and ask him to hold the ground around the village. Have him post men on the hills and then ask him to join us. Moulin, have the men guard the gates. Whoever did this won't be coming back, but it pays to be vigilant. We'll look inside and then move on. There's no point in staying in this butcher's yard." He tethered the belligerent horse away from the others, and, with Kilbert and John Jacob, stepped up to the house's main door, past the dead servants and into the gloom of the stone walls. The damp air drew their breath into a mist. John Jacob walked ahead, sword ready. He shouldered open a door that led into the great hall. Embers still crackled in a fireplace. The stonework was smudged with smoke, and the smell of it lingered in the room. John Jacob bent and pressed a torch of bound faggots into the gloom, blew on it, and, once it flared, held it aloft. The glow reached into the farthest corner. Tapestries had been ripped from the walls, benches overturned, wine and scraps of food had spilled across the dining table. The killers had obviously stayed long enough to raid the kitchen. A body slumped by a wall panel in a spreading pool of blood, still wet, that settled across the floorboards beneath the scuffed reed covering. Another servant, his head caved in, blood plastering his matted hair across his face. A meat cleaver had fallen from his hand, but there was no blood on its cutting edge. It had been a futile attempt at self-defense. A hunting dog was close by, its skull crushed. "Killed the man's dogs. There'll be others outside, I'll wager. said John Jacob. "Put the light over here, John," said Kilbert, pointing to a dark corner of the room. A narrow passage almost concealed a door.
"Bedchamber," said Blackstone. "Have a look, Gilbert."
Kilbert cautiously opened the door, with John Jacob at his side, and the flaming torch pushed forward. Blackstone heard the veteran curse.
"God's tears, Thomas. These are vile men who have gone before us. Killing will be too good for them."
Blackstone joined them at the entrance to the bedchamber. A woman of about 40 years had been tied spread-eagle across the bed, and her clothes ripped from her. She was no servant. The quality of her gown told them that. It was obvious she was the knight's wife. Her head was twisted to one side, her mouth slightly open, eyes glazed in death. That she had been raped was beyond question, and then they had mutilated her. Kilbert gestured towards what was concealed behind the door. A man, beard and hair grey, blood-streaked, was bound to a chair. John Jacob put an arm across his nose and mouth to filter the stench in the room.
"Tied him up and made him watch them do that to his wife," said Gilbert. "And then, after they gelded him, they gutted him."
A clothes chest had been plundered, those pieces not wanted discarded. "Searching for jewellery and gold," said Kilbert, as he moved to the far side of the bed and saw that some of the timbers had been levered up. "A man usually hides his treasure close to where he sleeps." He spat the stench from his throat. "Enough of this, Thomas. Let's be gone." The three men left the room, but as they strode back across the hall, a shadow lurched from an alcove, a glint of steel slashing down. Blackstone turned on his heel, wolf's sword raised, but he slipped in the still wet blood from the slain servant. John Jacob threw the burning torch at the attacker, who instinctively shielded himself from the flying sparks. In the instant of the attack, the men saw that the assailant had a lame arm and a blood-encrusted scalp. He was obviously weakened. This was the last desperate lunge of a brave man. Blackstone was already on his feet as the man fell, and before Kilbert instinctively delivered a killing blow, Wolf's sword blocked Kilbert's strike.
"Wait!"
Blackstone commanded. The man squirmed onto his back, favouring his injured arm across his chest as Blackstone stood on his other wrist, forcing him to release his sword.
"Murdering scum!" spat the assassin. "Be done with it and burn in hell!"
John Jacob kicked the sword away. Blackstone and the others looked down on their attacker. It was doubtful he had yet seen his 17th year. The likeness of the whiskers on his face were those of a boy. His leather jerkin was darkened with a patch of blood over his left shoulder. His age was not unusual. There were many like him in the army.
"We are not the ones who did this," said Blackstone.
The boy's face creased in uncertainty. How long had he been unconscious? Blackstone wondered. The lad must have come to thinking the killers were still in the house.
"Get to your feet, lad, and keep your hand away from that knife on your belt," said Kilbert.
The boy's strength seemed to have deserted him. He half raised himself, but then slumped. Blackstone's gesture stopped John Jacob from reaching down to help him.
"Let him do it on his own," he said, wanting to test the boy's determination. "Come on, boy. You can't lie down like a beaten dog on your feet."
Blackstone's taunt gave the boy strength, and he got first to one knee and then to his feet, lifting his injured arm to stop its weight causing him more pain.
"Who are you?" said the injured boy. "Where are my mother and father?"
Kilbert and Blackstone exchanged glances.
"The lord? And his wife?" said Kilbert.
The look in the boy's eyes was enough of an acknowledgement.
"They're dead," said Blackstone bluntly.
The boy grimaced. He looked at Blackstone.
"Where?"
"Best you don't see them," said John Jacob.
The boy looked towards the bedroom door and took a stride forward, but Kilbert blocked his path.
"Listen to us, lad. Leave them be."
He had the good sense to step back from the veteran knight, who looked as formidable as the taller, scar-faced man who stood at his side.
"You are English," he said uncertainly. "Routiers?"
"We're not mercenaries. We serve the English king.
We travel east to fight the Skinners," said Kilbert.
The young man hesitated. The English are our enemy, but I'll ride with you because I must avenge what has happened here. Will you take me?
No, said Blackstone.
What?
You're injured, and your blood boils. I know what it's like. You lose reason. When you kill, you need to unleash the bloodlust, but also to let your mind rule your actions. Bring those two together, and it's formidable. You don't have the experience to fight like that.
Treat my wound, and let me join you. Otherwise I'll go alone.
Horses are gone, said John Jacob. There's no food left, and your wound will poison you. You won't get far on foot. You'll be wolf-bait in 2 days.
The boy lowered his head, the turmoil of his anger forcing him to beg. Please, he whispered, help me avenge my family and all those loyal to us who are killed here.
Where is this place? Said Kilbert.
Saint-Bernice de la Grave, the boy answered.
Blackstone hid his surprise. You're the son of Mouton de la Grave, lord of this manor?
I am, said the boy.
Blackstone nodded to himself. Fate, it seemed, had brought him to the leper son's door. All right, you can ride with us. Your father had more courage than most fighting men. His son deserves a chance to follow in his footsteps. The boy struggled for a moment with the realization that he had suddenly been accepted.
I am grateful to you. My name is Alain de la Grave.
I know, said Blackstone. Chapter 16 Blackstone and the others stepped outside. Griffith ap Madoc sat on horseback, flanked by 50 or so of his men. Moulin, Renfred, Will Longdon, Jack Halfpenny, and all their men were on their knees, hands behind their heads, weapons laid on the ground in front of them. Alongside the Welshman was William Cade. Two of his men stood over Peter Garland and Will Longdon, who knelt, hands bound in front of them with ropes around their necks. Griffith ap Madoc raised a hand when Blackstone and Kilbert stepped through the doorway, John Jacob behind them, helping the wounded boy.
No further, Thomas.
Blackstone stopped and placed a restraining hand on Kilbert.
Horse son bastard, said Kilbert.
Ah, Gilbert, sighed ap Madoc. Now you guessed this might happen. Don't tell me you didn't. You kill us now, Griffith. And Chandos will hear of it sooner or later, and then the king, said Blackstone. The big Welshman shrugged. I know, I know. Thomas, I have a fondness for you, and Kilbert is a good companion to have at your side when the French throw their weight at you. But this is business. A transaction has taken place, and I have mouths to feed and men's greed to quench. He patted the saddlebags that were slung across his horse's withers. You lied to me, Thomas. Now what kind of friendship can be based on distrust, I ask you? Blackstone looked at the sneering William Cade, who leaned across his pommel. So that's what you were doing in ap Madoc's camp last night, telling him about the gold from Saint-Aubin.
It seemed only fair that I be paid for my efforts. Chandos is more frugal with the king's gold than a nun selling her cunny.
You could have taken the money sooner, said Blackstone to the Welshman.
No, that would have caused bloodshed between us. This place presented itself, you inside the walls, me outside with my men.
Take the money, said Blackstone, and take the ropes off my men.
Ah, now, Thomas, you show me no respect. Am I a fool to be taunted? If I do that, the moment I turned my back, a flight of arrows would find their mark. And then you will have the gate closed, knowing I cannot lay siege to you. I take these men as hostage and leave them at the far end of the village. That will give me enough time to be long gone and out of range of your archers. You can see that makes sense, can't you? Harm them, and you and the murdering bastard next to you will be my blood enemy. I swear it, Griffith. I swear it in front of every man here.
William Cade tugged on the rope around Will Longdon's neck.
You threaten us when we have the lives of your men in our hands.
He laughed.
Blackstone quickly strode forward half a dozen paces through his kneeling men. Horsemen's swords cleared scabbards, and those Welshmen who carried spears lowered them in anticipation of Blackstone attacking Ap Madoc. But Blackstone had moved so that he could face both antagonists, and that they would see the reality of his threat in his eyes. He stood as close as he dare, without Will Longdon and Peter Garland being yanked down and dragged away. He looked directly at William Cade.
"If you know anything of those I have killed, then you will know that I do not make idle threats. I say again, harm them, and you will know more pain than you thought possible before I kill you."
Griffith Ap Madoc scowled.
"I intend no hurt to befall them, Thomas. I seek only a safe retreat from your anger and your archers."
Blackstone pointed at Cade, and the threat was unmistakable. His voice hardened.
"It is him I warn, Griffith. But if my men suffer injury, you will both be held accountable, no matter who inflicts it on them. Blood and death will follow you."
William Cade tossed the rope, holding Will Longdon to one of the men.
"If they're too slow to keep up and fall and scrape their knees, what then? You'll bring more than curses down on our heads. No matter what threats you make, Blackstone, you bleed like any other man, and I will not turn away when the day comes. I've killed tougher men than you."
Blackstone didn't answer. He had made his promise, and saw that it had struck the pardoned murderer as firmly as the blow he had given him before. The Welsh veteran was losing patience.
"William Cade and his men will have their share of the gold flanks, so there is no cause for him to bear malice towards these two archers, or to test your desire for retribution. You wait long enough for us to clear the village, and then you can do what you want. Give chase, and we will turn and fight, and you are not stupid enough to pit yourself against hundreds of men."
He wheeled his horse.
"I bear you no ill will. Neither you nor Gilbert. I take what is needed, and that is all. Sir John Chandos can keep the writs bearing the king's seal and all that they promise. Gold coin is gold coin, and when men die every day, there is no damn time to wait for a fucking writ. Stand your ground, Thomas, and then come for your men."
Griffith Ap Madoc spurred his horse and cantered from the yard. His horsemen turned to follow, and Will Longdon and Peter Garland fell in at the rear of the horsemen. They would be obliged to run as the horses trotted. Will Longdon glanced back.
"It's a mile or so, Thomas. No more. Even I can run that."
And with that, the men cleared the courtyard. No sooner were they through the gates than Blackstone's men quickly armed themselves.
"We give chase, Sir Thomas?" asked Moulin, buckling his sword. "We can keep them in sight long enough."
"No. I don't want to give Cade any excuse to kill Will and the boy."
"He is a twisted creature, Moulin." "He'll take pleasure in plunging a knife into them," said Kildare. "Give them space."
"How long do we wait?" asked Jack Halfpenny.
"Long enough to bind this man's wound," he said, beckoning John Jacob to bring Alain de la Grave forward. "Jack, gather your bowmen and hold these walls in case they change their minds and return. Moulin, you and Renfred ready the men. Gilbert, pick 10 men and hold this place until I am back. We might need it."
"Thomas, leave Halfpenny and the archers here. Bowmen are no good to you in the trees, but the rest of us are."
Kildare was right. The thought of trying to keep any of the men-at-arms out of an ambush was the wrong choice. Blackstone laid a hand on his friend's shoulder. "We'll take all the men, but I'll lead. I want you on my flank. Split the men. You take Renfred, I'll have John and Moulin with me." Alain de la Grave had been propped against the wall. His leather tunic eased off him, and the blood-soaked linen shirt cut away from the clinging wound by one of Jack Halfpenny's archers.
"I will come with you," the Frenchman said.
"No. There will be enough time for that."
He looked to Halfpenny, searched the kitchen and cellars. "See if the raiders left any honey. Wash that wound. Smear it into the cut. Then stitch it. Bind him tight with clean linen when that's done."
"Aye, Sir Thomas."
"You'll need brandy, for when they use needle and thread on you," he told the boy.
I will be all right,
de la Grave said bravely. As you like, said Blackstone, and turned to the waiting men. We go slowly. Sir Gilbert will ride around the village and use the stream to come up behind any of those bastards who might be waiting. The Welshman will not use all those men. There are too many of them, but 60 or so could be waiting. The rest of us will ride straight into the village. If we have no choice, we ride back here, behind the walls. He brought the horse to the head of the men and rode through the gates. Like a sword blade from the coals hammered on a blacksmith's anvil, the old rage beat in his chest. Chapter 17 Griffith ap Madoc led the band of mercenaries away from an enraged Thomas Blackstone. The world they lived in brought fighting men together, but it also demanded that each look to his own well-being. And there were times when old bonds of comradeship had, by necessity, to be loosened. And 2,500 gold francs meant there was a lot of slack. He kept the horses at a slow trot, so that the two men at the rear with ropes around their necks did not stumble. Even without inflicting further humiliation or pain on these men, he knew Blackstone would seek him out. He glanced back and saw the huge body of horsemen behind him. One thing was certain, with this many men it would be impossible to hide their tracks, and if Thomas Blackstone followed, then he would have no problem finding them. He resisted the urge to heel his mount into a canter. Once the men were released at the village, then he would give the horses their heads. No matter what trail he left behind, the greater the distance between him and Thomas Blackstone and Kilbert, the better. He knew Blackstone would not be foolish enough to attack so many with so few, but he also knew that the Englishman would one day find a way to confront his theft and betrayal. Will Longdon felt the rope's knot beneath his chin as he ran to keep up with the mercenary. 20 paces ahead, who had been tasked by Cade with holding the length of rope. Peter Garland ran alongside, and he too kept his chin high to avoid the chafing hemp. Both men's lungs burned. Will Longdon spat phlegm from the back of his throat. Sweat stung his eyes, and the shirt stuck to his back beneath his jupon. Peter, almost there, boy. The young archer glanced his way and nodded with gritted teeth. It was obvious to Longdon the boy's fear might get the better of him, and what he also knew in his heart was that William Cade would hang them, no matter what assurances Griffith ap Madoc had given Blackstone. He needed the boy to be thinking clearly, because if they were to escape the noose, they had to do it before they reached the village, and the Welshman brought the horses to a halt. Peter, listen. You hear me? Once again the boy looked his way and nodded. We have to take our chance before we reach the village. We can't trust them, you understand? The boy's brow furrowed with uncertainty, and then he understood what the veteran archer was telling him. He nodded. How? The last bend in the road before we reach the village. The forest is on the left of the track and is dense enough for us to hide in until Thomas and Sir Gilbert come looking for us, as they surely will. Cade was humiliated, and the turd will take his revenge. I'm sure of it. You hold tight onto the rope. Both men were grasping the length of rope in front of their faces to ease the chafing. Longdon gestured with his clenched fist. When I tell you, you pull hard, dig in your heels, let your back take the weight, like drawing your bow, you understand? Curve your back and yank the rope. If we don't pull the riders from the saddle, we might rip the rope from their hands. Then we run into the undergrowth, and we keep running until we find the filthiest shithole to crawl into, somewhere they won't poke their noses looking for us. They won't search for long, not with Thomas and the others on their way. With luck, the Welshman doesn't want to fight, even if he does outnumber us. Understand, boy? Use your strength, and then run. I've a knife in my boot, so I can cut the rope, but we need to get distance between us and them. Got it? We run and hide. Peter Garland looked frightened. Aye, me too, lad, said Will Longdon. He smiled and drew another deep breath from the exertion. But it's the fear that gives us legs. He looked ahead. William Cade had eased his horse free of the jostling riders, and as the two men who held the ropes
approached him. He made a small gesture with his hand, a movement that indicated something ahead that was higher than the rider's head. Will Longdon squinted through the sweat. His archer's keen eyesight picked out a chestnut tree with an overhanging bough. It was barely 12 feet above the track. A rope thrown and tied off on a horse's pommel would haul him and Garland fast enough to break their necks.
"Mother of Christ, help us," he whispered to himself as his gut instinct was confirmed. "Peter, we do this now. Hear me? There's no more time."
The young archer's eyes widened, but he nodded. Longdon held his gaze a moment longer, and then, as the horses ahead slowed under Cade's command, he gathered the strength in his arms and back and heaved on the rope. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Garland do the same. There was immediate slack. The riders were taken by surprise at the archer's strength, and the ropes fell free from their grasp. The two archers ran for the cover of the trees, trailing the telltale lengths of rope. Cries of alarm went up, but the horses, plunging in distress, impeded each other and were unable to turn quickly enough for their riders to see where the two men had gone. No sooner had Longdon plunged into the forest than he was sawing the rope around his neck with a short-bladed skinning knife hidden in his boot. Garland tried to keep pace, but the tangled bramble kept catching his legs. Will Longdon jumped across a hurdle of fallen branches towards him. They had made barely 30 yards, and as Longdon cut Garland's bonds, he could see horsemen urging their mounts into the trees. The moment Garland's hands were free, he took the knife and freed Will Longdon's bindings, and then desperately tried to cut the length of rope from his own neck.
"Hurry!"
hissed Longdon. But the rope was thicker and was taking longer to cut than the veteran archers. One of the horsemen saw them, and although he cried out to his comrades, Longdon realized that the others could not see them because a tall swathe of bramble obscured their position. The horseman was urging his horse to twist left and right through the trees in their direction. Longdon snatched the knife and took a fistful of Garland's rope, and with more strength than the boy possessed, cut the rope, yanking the blade across the hemp. The rope separated, but the force of his efforts loosened the knife from his grip, and it tumbled into the undergrowth.
"Leave it," said Longdon.
They turned, and ignoring the tearing thorns, pushed deeper, lungs raw with exertion, they ran for their lives, but the crashing sound of the horsemen was getting closer. Will Longdon could hear running water, but there was no sign of the river that skirted the village. If they could reach it, and it was fast flowing, they might have a chance to be swept beyond the horses. He dared a glance over his shoulder. Garland was keeping up, but one of the horsemen was now less than 20 paces behind them, and had found a gap in the trees to force his horse through. Cade's man gripped his sword, ready to cut them down. Further back, two other horsemen urged their horses towards him. Will Longdon's instincts took over. The memory of charging horsemen at Crecy and Poitiers flared in his memory, and once again he summoned the heart-stopping courage it took for men to stand their ground and kill their enemy.
"Run, boy, run!"
he yelled, as he turned to face the horsemen. He snatched a fallen bough. Its branches flayed like a witch's claw, and thrust it at the horse. It reared. The rider yanked the reins, but the huge beast had lost its footing and fell sideward. Longdon hurled himself at the cursing man, who was already half up as the archer's weight struck him. Longdon hit him hard in the face with his fist, and the man reeled, but he was strong enough to absorb the blow and threw himself onto Longdon. In that moment, the archer knew that while he was sturdy, the other man was heavier and stronger. He was 10 years younger, and knew he had the advantage. Neither man cursed, each holding their breath from the exertion as they grappled. Cade's man suddenly had a knife in his hand. Longdon snatched at his face, clawing at the man's eyes. He brought a knee up into his groin, and Cade's man grunted, but even that did not lessen his grip. Will Longdon pulled the man's weight down onto him, smothering the knife hand as it got caught in the undergrowth. Longdon pushed his thumb into the man's mouth and clutched the flesh of his face, tearing the lips and cheek open. The man bellowed, but the agony gave him added strength. The two men rolled, each fighting for the knife. Will Longdon headbutted his opponent. Blood splattered the man's face as his nose cracked, and then, as the horseman gradually gained the upper hand, Longdon reared up, throwing his weight against him. But the man's grip held firm on Longdon's jupon, and the archer knew that if he fell onto him, the knife would find his belly. Suddenly the ground gave way and both men fell, still clutching each other, through the undergrowth and down the stone-strewn embankment. Within seconds they hit the river. Will Longdon's attacker had tumbled beneath him, and Longdon fought to keep his body on top as they plunged into the shallow water. The man seemed weaker, and the archer realized he must have caught his head on a rock. Although he still flailed, Longdon suddenly had the upper hand. He forced his knee into the man's back, grabbed his collar with one hand and his hair with the other, and twisted his head, forcing it beneath the water. The man squirmed, legs kicking, his desperation to survive the fight forcing strength back into his body. Will Longdon found that deep-seated place within himself and drew on its killing energy, forcing the power from his shoulders into his arms and fists. And then the man went still. The archer kept his weight on the man's back until he was sure he was dead. Exhausted but still alert for the other horseman, he slumped back into the waist-deep water and steadied his breathing. Voices carried from the forest above. He stumbled to the embankment and pressed himself into the dirt wall. He dared to glance downstream, but there was no sign of Peter Garland. He should have made good his escape. Now Longdon had bought him time. The voices sounded closer. Longdon smeared mud and dirt from the riverbank onto his face and jupon, then grabbed handfuls of grass and weed, pushing it here and there into his belt and neck opening. Anyone riding close by would not recognize a man half-submerged, camouflaged with mud and leaf. There was nothing more Longdon could do other than wait and hope that Cade and Ap Maddox's men would ride on. The light fluttered before his eyes. He pushed aside the overhanging undergrowth, but still the grey light flickered through the trees. He blinked. He felt the chill of the water on his thighs and waist. It tugged at him. The water was deeper than he thought, and he shivered from its chill. Sweat from the fight slithered down his spine. He suddenly felt weak, and his head began to pound. He touched the wet hair on the back of his head, and his hand came away covered in blood. Like the man he had killed, he must have cracked his skull on the downward plunge, and his urge to survive had smothered the pain from the injury. He cursed beneath his breath. It felt as though he was falling asleep. He had lost all sense of time. How long had he been hiding? He snatched back his head, as his chin drooped onto his chest. Horsemen were approaching. If he couldn't stay awake, they would find him, and then he would hang. Just like the current pulling at him, unconsciousness was carrying him away. He slipped lower, chest deep, tried to find his footing but couldn't. He cursed, disbelievingly. He thought he had won the fight. Like a lover's gentle enticement, the river eased him away.
Chapter 18 When Griffith Ap Maddox saw the archer's hanged body, he hauled William Cade from the saddle and threw him to the ground. Cade's men drew their swords, but Ap Maddox's Welshman quickly boxed them in.
"You dog turd! I gave my word!"
His great bulk loomed over the English mercenary, sword point hovering over Cade's throat. Cade scuttled backwards away from the blade, but the Welshman planted his boot onto Cade's chest.
"I out, Blackstone," Cade spat. "He humiliated me in front of my men." "Humiliated?" said Ap Maddox, rolling the word on his tongue to savour its meaning. "Made you look like the sewer rat you are. Stopped you torturing a man is what I heard." "It was me who told you about the gold," Cade said hastily. "And I paid you your share. There won't be enough gold to keep me alive anywhere in this peasant shit country now you have unleashed Thomas Blackstone. I will be hunted. Even if I go to the French, they will use me to bargain with the English. I'm a routier. I have no ally. We fight for each other. No one will save me from the rope or Blackstone's sword. Every damned Englishman will be happy to hunt me like a cur dog so they can please him." The sword pressed closer to Cade's throat. Why, I can be of use to you,"
the Welshman murmured in his own language.
"Mor diwyth ar eich gaffer."
Ap Maddox's horsemen sniggered and voiced their agreement. He spat, the globule landing on Cade's chest. He pressed the sword under the man's chin and a trickle of blood ran down his neck.
"As useless as a sheep's fart."
It would take only the slightest pressure for the blade to pierce Cade's throat.
"I beg you, listen to me. I rode with Sir John Chandos. I know where all the towns are that are to be ceded to Edward. I know where all his troops will be. I can lead you away from the moor You need never see an Englishman again. Except you.
The sword hovered. There was some value in what the treacherous bastard said. Once word got out that a man serving with Ap Madoc had caused the Welshman's pledge to Blackstone to be broken, then, in the time it takes to break wind, Cade would be forgotten. It would be thought the mercenary leader himself had strung up the English bowmen. Even routiers needed some kind of honesty. Those who paid for their services expected they would keep their contract. He glanced up at the men who rode with him, and who benefited from their raiding together. They were veterans of the wars, and even those who came late, the tarred Venus, who drifted in looking for plunder, were ruthless but dependable. Dependable as long as there was money. And none wanted to face the wrath of any army or organized body of men because of a treacherous act. There were others who would hang, draw, and quarter every one of them because of their past actions.
"I have enough shit on my boots," said the Welshman, raising his sword.
Blackstone and his men approached the village. They rode slowly and deliberately, looking for any sign of ambush. It seemed unlikely, Blackstone reasoned. The Welshman could have slaughtered them in the courtyard. There would be no need to risk injury to his own men in the open. No, this was a simple case of theft, and for the thief buying time. They brought their horses to a halt on the muddy track when they saw the body hanging from the low overhang. Griffith, Ap Madoc, and his men were long gone, and with them any thought Blackstone had of him being a brazen cutpurse. He was a murderer. The rope creaked as the wind moved the bow. The body swayed.
"Cut him down,"
said Blackstone, keeping his eyes on the dead man's face, grieving for the loss of a comrade, regretting the needless death of a fighting man. The thought that his trust of Griffith Ap Madoc had brought it about flayed him. But, he answered himself, it was an Englishman's betrayal. Cade had told the Welshman about the gold. Greed and treachery had led to this. Two men went forward to retrieve the body as a third lowered the rope tied around the tree trunk. The men cut the rope and laid the dead archer gently in the grass at the side of the track.
"I would not have thought it of the Welshman," said John Jacob. "He fought at Sir Gilbert's side all those years ago."
"A man changes, John," said Blackstone. "Perhaps he did it as a warning for me not to follow him."
"And will we?"
"In time. First we must bury the dead and attend to the king's business." He eased the bastard horse closer to the dead archer. The men stepped away as he gazed down. "Put him across a horse and bring him back," said Blackstone. He looked up at the cut rope, as frayed as the past.
Kilbert led his men along the riverbed, around the flank of the village. They could see through the overhanging trees that there were no horsemen in sight, but they were downwind, and the stench of the rotting corpses wafted sickeningly over them. There would soon be more creatures of the forest feasting on the dead, if they weren't already. Kilbert glanced left and right as his horse picked his way through the river stones beneath its hooves. A body lay face down, his leather jerkin billowing from the air trapped beneath it, which had allowed the dead man to float and be caught against the river bank. Kilbert brought the men to a halt. It was a good place for an ambush, and using a dead man as bait was not uncommon. With practiced ease, some of the men urged their horses up the lower left-hand bank to shield those in the water in case a sudden charge came out of the village. The others stayed alert, scanning the high bank opposite. It was smothered with undergrowth, the trees diminishing the light. Kilbert gestured, and Renfred eased his horse forward and quickly dismounted, turning the dead man over.
"It's one of Cade's men. He's been in a fight. Half his face gone, ripped and beaten."
"Let him rot," said Kilbert, keeping a wary eye on the surroundings.
The near side bank showed no sign of horses' hooves.
"If he's down here, he must have come from up there," he said, pointing to the high bank.
He rode forward, peering into the gloom of the river that darkened the closer it flowed near the village. The overhanging branches interlocked, creating a roof, keeping the damp chill trapped, that and the stench. Some of the villagers had tried to run for the safety of the river when the village had first been attacked, but the killers had blocked any retreat. There were bodies lying on the low muddy bank, half in, half out of the water. Hair swirled in the slow but insistent current. A woman's arm flopped into the water. her hand waving gently in macabre farewell. Further ahead in the gloom, a body was caught on a fallen tree branch. The man's arm had caught the branch, and the submerged trunk had stopped him floating further downriver. Kildare stiffened and then spurred his horse. He dismounted and waded quickly to the man who wore a jupon like the rest of them. Kildare wrapped his arms around Will Longdon. Dead or alive, he couldn't tell.
"Will?"
"You're safe now, man. You're safe. We've got you." Renfred was at his side and eased the unconscious body out of the water and onto the bank. Kildare clambered after him. Renfred laid a hand beneath Longdon's jupon.
"His heart beats, Sir Gilbert, but his lost blood and the cold water has taken its toll."
"Fetch my blanket from my bedroll and bring my brandy flask," said Kildare, kneeling and gently tapping his palm against Longdon's face. He tugged away the ferns and grass from his collar and belt. Renfred draped Kildare's blanket over the injured archer as Kildare lifted his head and dribbled brandy between his lips.
"Come on, lad. You've been hurt worse than this before now. Come on," he urged gently.
After a few moments, Will Longdon spluttered. Kildare grinned at the others. "I've known this whoremongering archer since Morlaix, and in those 20 years I've never seen Will Longdon refuse brandy." He slapped Longdon's face harder. Longdon flinched and opened his eyes.
"Mother of Christ, Sir Gilbert," he gasped, looking dazed,
eyes darting back and forth at the faces grinning down at him.
"You're still a malingering whoreson, Will Longdon," said Kildare, "and now we find you skulking in a river dressed like a damned woodland fairy,"
he said, clutching the torn ferns and grass in his fist. Longdon groaned.
"Aye, well, I couldn't go back without bathing, or you'd have complained I stank after the exertions I endured."
Kildare nodded. "We saw Cade's man back a ways. It looked as though you had a fight on your hands."
"God's tears, Will, you're getting old and slow."
Will Longdon grinned.
"That's the truth, Sir Gilbert. A drop more brandy might warm what blood I have left in me."
Kildare eased the flask to his lips.
"I'll take payment from your purse, when I find it."
Longdon sighed.
"I would expect nothing less, Sir Gilbert.
Where's Peter Garland?"
Chapter 19 Blackstone withdrew the men behind the gates of Saint-Bernice. They tipped the bodies of de la Grave's defenders over the walls and posted guards. Night beckoned, so it made no sense to ride on to meet Sir John Chandos. Besides, the boy archer needed to be buried, and Will Longdon's wound stitched. Once that was done, the captain set about organizing their men. Perrine had returned from his patrol and reported that the tracks left by the attackers had been lost at the edge of a dense forest. Food was cooked, and sentry duties allocated. Alain de la Grave was asleep next to the fire that now blazed in the great hall. The blood had been sluiced from the floor, and the bodies of the dead servants taken outside and placed downwind. Kildare pulled off his boots, still wet from wading in the river, and settled his feet in front of the fire. Candlelight glimmered as the men laid down their blankets. Except for their turns at sentry duty, they would all sleep inside the great hall.
"I swear I have heard more sense coming out of a pig's arse," Kildare said, extending the brandy flask to Blackstone, who shared the fireside. "Bretons slaughter their way through territory because they are not part of the treaty. We have routiers hunting routiers, the French army chasing them up, Englishmen chasing them down. King John paying brigands to abandon the towns they hold so that Edward can nail his name above the gates. French towns ceding to Edward, some refusing, others being bribed. We pay gold coin on behalf of the crown and make an alliance with 300 mercenaries led by a treacherous Welshman and are betrayed by an Englishman stealing the king's money who serves Sir John Chandos, Knight of the Garter, friend of the king and a fine judge of men."
"It's called peace," said Blackstone, handing back the flask.
"Thomas, I want a simple life. Show me my enemy and let me kill him. Raise the flags, beat the drums, and let the trumpets blow across the battlefield."
"Perhaps that will come again if Edward doesn't get the territory he won."
"That we won?
We serve our sovereign lord, Thomas,
but it is our blood that nourishes this godforsaken land.
That's the price we paid, Gilbert.
And gladly. But are we to spend our days wandering the land like tax collectors? The time will come when everything due is paid. What of us then? What about taking the cross and going on crusade?
Blackstone's eyes widened. Kildare shrugged.
To seek out a decent fight, Thomas. We defended the Pope against the Visconti. Why not do more?
We fought for Florence against the Visconti. Don't confuse the two things, Gilbert.
Kildare rubbed his feet, warming to the idea.
But, Thomas, think of it. You have several hundred men still under contract to Florence. Master Alfred still commands them. They're still being paid. The bankers in Florence would back you. Then Edward would smile graciously in our direction and give us more men and, who knows, perhaps more money. We could ride to warmer climes and fight the Moor. It's an idea worth considering.
Blackstone got to his feet and laid a hand on his friend's shoulder. First, let's do our duty. Then we retrieve the king's gold. In the meantime, I shall check the perimeter, and you keep an eye on the boy there, he said, meaning de la Grave.
Kildare's tone softened. We lost a good lad today, Thomas. This Frenchman is no archer. It's a poor exchange.
But he has courage, his friend answered, and stepped towards the darkness.
There was enough light from the moon behind the clouds to see the dark shape of the walls and the forest beyond the clearing. Blackstone went up onto the walkway. He could see shapes moving beyond the walls, and the snuffling told him wolf and boar had come from the forest to feast on the dead. The corpses in the village and those slain here at the manor house would feed the scavengers for weeks to come. The crows had already pecked the soft flesh, eyes jabbed from sockets and tongues plucked out. The carnage was nothing compared to a battlefield, but the gentle beauty of this lush countryside deserved life. He stood still and let his vision grow more accustomed to the near darkness. Sentries patrolled their posts, their cloaks pulled tight. Night spirits flitted through the forest, seeking out the souls of the dead. He could sense them, felt their cool touch on his cheek. It was no breeze that caressed him, or drizzle that settled on his beard. It was the tears of those damned to half-life between earth and heaven. He kissed the silver goddess.
"Sir Thomas," said an approaching shadow.
"Will?"
"You should be with the others. Get some sleep."
"I've done the rounds," said Will Longdon. "Didn't much feel like sleeping yet."
"Your head?"
"Thudding like a drum. All stitched. Moulin did it. Christ, his hands are like bloody hams. I swear I've more cord in the back of my head than on my bow. And he stitched me so tight I've a permanent grin on my face."
He sensed Blackstone's smile in the darkness.
"He's changed since we lost Gaillard back in Milan," said Blackstone.
"Aye. He's more ready to kill, if that's possible. Give him half a chance and he would go after the Welshman alone.
Maybe we should let him."
"In good time," said Blackstone. They fell silent as they walked the walls.
"I should have saved young Garland," Longdon said after a while. "I tried, Thomas. I got us away from Cade's men. Cut his rope, but then I had a fight on my hands. Didn't think they'd catch him."
"There's no telling what happened. We lose a man and we go over it 100 times, but no amount of flogging ourselves brings them back. We go on. Carry them with us."
The two men passed the sentry. It was one of Moulin's men-at-arms. Blackstone greeted him. There was nothing to report from his post, other than the scurrying shadows from the forest and the unsettling sound of night creatures crunching bones.
"Go and rouse a half-dozen men. Bring torches, and drop them over the walls where the bodies are. Let's give the dead some peace for the night."
The man hesitated.
"Go!
Will and I will stay at your post until you're back." The man went down the steps into the yard and set off towards the hall.
"Talking of harms, Moulin went through the cellars and found some food and drink for the lads," said Longdon. "The murdering scum who did the killing here had missed it. I've left a smoked ham and wine for Sir Gilbert. He's sharing it out now with the men."
"Good. Make sure they keep some for the sentries when they come off."
"Already done."
The two men gazed across the shadow.